Here's an archival recording by TUC Radio in honor of Ramsey Clark. Former U.S. Attorney General and longtime human rights lawyer Ramsey Clark died on April 10, 2021. After leaving office, Clark became a leading critic of U.S. foreign policy. He said, "The world is the most dangerous place it's ever been because of what our country has done and is doing, and we have to take it back." I recorded him in San Francisco on October 12, 2002. There he warned of another war in Iraq. However, in spite of huge peace demonstrations across the world, Iraq was attacked on March 19, 2003, and a never-ending war began. Here's my archival recording of Ramsey Clark's moving and inspiring speech.
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Stop the war on Iraq. Let Iraq live. The elder statesman of the anti-war movement, Ramsey Clark, has called for peace for Vietnam, the Philippines, Chiapas, Iraq, and Yugoslavia. With little regard for his personal safety, he has visited the war zones in these countries to discover firsthand the impact of U.S. foreign policy. While the bombs fell on Iraq in 1991, he traveled 2,000 miles by car. On the ground, he visited hospitals and devastated neighborhoods. After the Gulf War, he wrote The Fire This Time, which records the reality of this war and describes the war crimes committed by the military and civilian leaders of the U.S. He now travels across the U.S. to warn us of the consequences of beginning yet another war in Iraq, both for the poor and tortured people of that country and for us, for our own safety and for our own souls. Here is Ramsey Clark, recorded on October 12 in San Francisco. The Blue Angel fighter planes passed over the high school where he spoke, in their celebration of military might for Columbus Day 2002. Ramsey Clark.
I'm going to start by going back 510 years when the first Spanish ships touched shore on Hispaniola, and observe some of the developments since then, because I think they tell us, in Lincoln's words, whither we may tend if we don't make a radical change in the government of the United States. The best estimates of the number of Indian peoples on Hispaniola when Columbus arrived were 1,200,000. In 1517, it was estimated that 50,000 had survived. When we look back at Spain, we see without much question what they were about. They were about domination and exploitation. Yet today, when we look at essentially the same thing, we wonder what it's all about. When George Bush announced his war on terrorism, he made the most radical step, and the most dangerous step, and the most lawless step in the history of the United States. And I think clearly it was intended to be the first breaking loose from the end of the Cold War for the outright assertion of U.S. dominion. And now we see an assertion of power, of raw power, that threatens all international law as we know it. and as we have struggled for its development and hoped for its role in the struggle for peace. First, we see the claim that the United States has the power to strike first. It can strike any nation. It can strike a nation because of grievances we have against that nation, or it can strike a nation because we claim that it is harboring terrorists. But who will ever know why it's really decided to strike, from what the United States government says? Since at least 1648 and the treaties of Westphalia, which ended two long wars, one for 100 years and one for 30 years, and established the recognition that each nation is sovereign and its sovereignty is not to be violated by any other nation, and the sovereignty of each nation is equal to the sovereignty of all other nations. Not to say that the people are equal, but just the nations. And now the United States has proclaimed the right to violate the sovereignty of any nation. It's not that we haven't violated the rights of nations all along, ask the Indian nations, or any nation in the Western Hemisphere. More than 80 violent interventions in the Western Hemisphere in the last 100 years. Hard to believe, but there they are. But now we're proclaiming the right. And we have this stunning power. I mean, we hear those murder machines flying over this peace conference, the Blue Angels. We have to realize there are no angels there. They're just machines that are very expensive, that are designed to kill a lot of people and to enable their domination. When we see something like the vote in the Congress, who's the greater danger to the people of the planet, including the people of this good country? The United States or Iraq? What have we done to Iraq? We hit Iraq beginning on the 17th of January 1991 with 110,000 aerial sorties. That's a lot of flights. They dropped more than 88,500 tons of bombs. They hit civilian targets up and down the country and from one side to the other. They deliberately targeted every type of facility that's essential to modern societies, and Iraq was a modern society. We destroyed their food in every way we knew how, including insecticide and fertilizer, plants and storage facilities, from the fields to the markets. We killed 150,000 people at least. There's one former Secretary of the Navy who says 200,000 in the bombing. That's a lot of people. We say we lost 155. That's terrible. One-third to friendly fire. The other great lesson was that we are prepared to use technology against life. And technology has the power for total destruction. All this time after the Cold War, which I used to think of as the greatest crime against humanity in history, and it was pretty bad. I mean, it just drained everything toward violence and brought whole continents down. But when you bring that up to date, you see that at this time, with total power almost, there's not a country we can't destroy, and there's not a country that doesn't know it. and they're countries that we have destroyed, in whole or in part, without setting foot on them, by direct violence and by indirect economic means. And still we have, and it's beyond rationality, 20 Trident II nuclear submarines commissioned. You have to think about things like that. What are these ships doing out there? They're as long as the Washington Monument is tall, but they're considerably stouter because they convey 24 missile launch tubes from which they can launch 24 missiles simultaneously. And each can have up to 17 independently targeted maneuverable nuclear warheads. And each can travel up to 7,000 nautical miles. And because it was conceived and built as a first strike weapon to knock out Soviet missiles as or before they emerged from silos, it can hit within 300 feet of a predetermined target, we're told. But we know how that goes. What it means, though, is that we can fire missiles in opposite directions and span 14,000 nautical miles, or more than halfway around Mother Earth's ample waste, and take out a hemisphere. 408 centers of human population could be hit with warheads 10 times more powerful than the bomb that incinerated Nagasaki, Umbeldi. We have far more nuclear warheads than the rest of the world combined. What are we doing with them? We have far more missiles than the rest of the world combined, and they're far more accurate, far greater range. We have a far greater budget to devise far more destructive, effective, precise weapons of mass destruction. Who's the greater danger to the people of the planet, including the people of this good country? The United States or Iraq? What have we done to Iraq? We hit Iraq beginning on the 17th of January 1991 with 110,000 aerial sorties. That's a lot of flights. They dropped more than 88,500 tons of bombs. They hit civilian targets up and down the country and from one side to the other. They deliberately targeted every type of facility that's essential to modern societies, and Iraq was a modern society. Within hours of the first launch, there was no electricity in the country, except for the few gasoline-powered emergency generators that they had. None for civilian populations, except for a handful of hospitals, about one hospital in three, maybe. Drinking water, running water, safe water, couldn't be found anywhere except from wells. In a city like Baghdad, which has 4.5-5 million people, there are no water wells. We destroyed their food in every way we knew how, including insecticide and fertilizer, plants and storage facilities, from the fields to the markets. We killed 150,000 people at least. There's one former Secretary of the Navy who says 200,000 in the bombing. That's a lot of people. We say we lost 155. That's terrible. One-third to friendly fire. One particular one is a family of a young man who was part of a tank unit. And his tank was hit by a silver bullet, depleted uranium tip, And this was a state-of-the-art tank, the latest Abrams. Drilled right through, tremendous heat, comes out the other side. Throws minute particles of depleted uranium high into the air and all around. Never can be refined. Blows with the wind. Washed down with the rain. Gets into the food chain. Gets into the water supply. We never asked what effect depleted uranium has on people. We had a new weapon, and we intended to use it. And we concealed it, then we lied about it, and finally it's known that we dropped more than 900 tons of depleted uranium on that country. And when you go to the hospitals, and particularly in the South, and finally the doctors are pulling together the effect of depleted uranium on the children there, and is absolutely unbelievable on the whole populations. The number of miscarriages with deformed fetuses, the number of live births with deformed infants, the number of cancers and similar things, deformities. They were having a training program, not in the training hospital, which I know best in Boston, but in the general hospital. They had about 50 people there who were medical team people who were, and they were looking at these photographs, and it was just unbelievable. Every American ought to have to see those and see what we have done. And as bad as all that violence is, it's nothing compared, or it's minor compared, to the most genocidal of our acts against Iraq. And those are the sanctions. First imposed on Hiroshima Day, August the 6th of 1990. I used to think things like that were just a coincidence. And then I've watched policy long enough to see that this is how government shows it doesn't give a damn about these things, you know. Meeting with the Red Crescent in Baghdad during the bombing, about the 5th or 6th day of February, 2.5 weeks into the bombing by that time. And the Red Crescent is, most of you would know, is the Islamic Nation's equivalent of the Red Cross, and they joined together pretty much in Geneva. And they had particular access to information because they were the sole delivery system for any medications that were coming into the country to outlying hospitals. They had about 7 vehicles and they were taken out there. And the rate of deaths from the sanctions was staggering. It involved many aspects. It involved overwhelmingly children under 5 and infants. Dehydration. You can get pills that will stop dehydration like that in an infant or in a child. And they cost 5 cents if you're buying from a rich pharmaceutical company instead of what they really are worth. But they didn't have any. And mothers were malnourished because they hadn't had enough food since August. They didn't have enough milk. They wanted to feed their baby, so they'd take water and sugar and put it in a bottle and feed the baby, and the water would be bad, and the baby would go. Today we know from every UN agency that has to deal with food or health or children or anything important in life what the sanctions have done. UNICEF reported in August of 91 that 47,500 children under the age of 5 could be identified as having died directly from the sanctions. It was a gross understatement, but it showed a recognition. In 1996, Food and Agriculture Organization, which ought to be 100 times what it is, because we're facing not only malnutrition among a billion and a half people at any given time, but we're facing starvation among tens of millions on three continents. And they reported in 1996, in October, that 585,000 children under the age of five have died as a direct result of the sanctions. Now, you think that's a mistake, but then you look at what we're saying and doing now, and you see that's exactly what we mean. Having our way is worth whatever it costs other people. What happens to our character and our conscience if we dare attack Iraq? Where is our humanity? What type of character do we have? There's a story out of Thucydides involving the Peloponnesian Wars in which the little island of Milos, which came under the sway of Athens because it had the fleets, but it had been non-aligned, and that was one thing we couldn't stand, refused, and it also had trees that were particularly good for masts for ships, and Athens needed the masts and the trees. The Medians refused to submit. The Athenian admiral said, "You don't understand. This is a world in which the powerful do as they will, and the weak suffer as they must." They prevented anything from coming in or out of the island for about 6 months. Then they invaded, and they killed the men, killed the young boys. And many historians believe that that was one of the most harmful things in the psyche of the Athenians that led toward their decline from their glorious days. The truth will out, and the truth about what we're doing will out. And the idea that Iraq is a threat to the United States is an absurd falsity, and anyone with common sense would know it. We claim we destroyed 80%. This is the Pentagon. We claim they destroyed 80%. Of course, they were bragging, but of all their capacity to wage war, including any capacity they had to develop weapons of mass destruction. They had a long time to develop weapons of mass destruction by 1991, but if they had developed any, they didn't use them, did they? Wonder why. That was a pretty tough time for them, a little bit serious. Then the UN inspectors claimed, after 8.5 years of intrusion beyond anything any country has ever experienced before, you can go anywhere, anytime, without notice and inspect anything, that they had found 90% of the materials that would be required to develop any type of weapon of mass destruction known to technology at the time, chemical, bacteriological, nuclear. And it would be so obviously and utterly suicidal. We say that they're an evil regime because over the past 20 years they've invaded two peoples, Kuwait and Iran. We backed them in Iran. And look at what the United States has done. Grenada, this menacing island of Grenada with nearly 100,000 people. And pretty soon we had 8,000 soldiers on there, and we killed more Grenadians than we lost in World War II in proportion to population in 3 days. They knew people who were lost, they lost members of their family, and they've never had their own country since. We attacked Nicaragua, bombed the harbor, mined the harbor, Corinto, attacked the aircraft landing strips. We were sued in the International Court of Justice, and we said, "We're not subject to your jurisdiction." We ticked our briefcases and went home, a lawless society. We attacked Libya, Afghanistan. Afghanistan known nothing but misery for 50 years, just as the Palestinians have known nothing but misery for 100 years. And the Palestinians and so many others have been addressed with nothing but force and deceit. The whole peace process, to me, has been nothing but force and deceit. Forcing them to relinquish land and relinquish rights. Their per capita income is not 1/12 the per capita income of Israel. We give Israel more income per capita in aid than sub-Saharan Africa has per capita from all sources. And we go on and on like that. The numbers of countries that we have assaulted physically would include Haiti, Iraq, more than 15 when you count them up. Defenseless. We used to think it was not right to shoot a defenseless person. Now we do exactly what Himmler said to the Gestapo. Shoot first, ask questions later, and I will protect you. That's serious, and it's true. And we have to come to grips with it. We have to come home. At this critical time in history, we could stand for peace. We could work for peace. Our country could move for peace. We could change our military budget to a peace budget. We could try to help the teeming poor of the planet. We could reach out to them and give them a chance to share in the wealth of their own energy, their own imagination, and their own physical resources. We have the capacity to do it. Instead, we deal through force, through fear, and through deception. We have to not only turn this country around quickly, because the President of the United States is about to make the most disastrous decision, something that he desperately wants to do. He's obsessed with it. All you got to do is watch what he's been saying for the last 6 months, not what he said last night. And you see that we're preparing for war there and elsewhere. And it'll only bring disaster, as war always has. So let's stand up now and march. March as never before. Let's march as if the life of the nation and the life of those we love the most and the life of the species that we are a part of depended on it, because it may. Thank you.
That was the former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark. For decades now, he has been a voice for peace. Peace for Vietnam, the Philippines, Chiapas, Yugoslavia, and Iraq. He traveled war zones in these countries while bombs were being dropped. After the Gulf War, he wrote The Fire This Time, which records the reality of this war and describes the war crimes committed by the U.S. government. You heard my recording of Ramsey Clark's appeal for peace on the eve of the U.S. attack on Iraq in March 2003. Ramsey Clark died on April 10, 2021, at the age of 93. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.